You're listening to Opus Talks, where you'll be in on conversations with insiders in the energy, chemicals, and environmental commodities markets. Guests share insights into the latest trends and innovations, industry challenges, and much more. Let's dive into the conversations that explore where the energy economy is headed, right here on Opus Talks.
Welcome to the latest edition of Opus Talks, and for this particular episode, the latest edition of our Tariff Talk podcast. I'm James Stevenson. I run the research group in coal, metals, and mining at Opus, which is part of the Dow Jones organization. Joining me today, as usual, is Charles Dayton. How are you doing, Charles?
Yeah, it's good to be with you again.
So I think we kind of, in a moment of levity at the end of the last podcast, I think we pondered maybe if we'd have something different to talk about other than Iran for this edition. And I think we do have some other things to talk about, but obviously Iran's still topic number one, two, and three. And we're recording this on the 15th of June. We've just had announcement around a memorandum of understanding by both sides, or I say both sides, it's really, there are many sides, but really between the US and Iran, on a potential peace deal and reopening of the strait and so forth. Charles, it feels like right now there's just not a whole lot of information about what this deal looks like. The other challenge, of course, is this podcast will come out in a few days, but it seems a little nebulous still, yeah?
I think that's probably putting it a little lightly, quite frankly. We don't even know what's in it. We haven't seen a copy. Our allies haven't seen a copy. American people, no one really has. The only copies we've seen are coming from Iran. And we kind of just have to, in the article we put out today, which you should all be seeing here pretty soon, we had to kind of take that as a baseline and then assume that anything that was incorrect would be refuted by the U.S. So there could be a lot of reasons why we're not seeing it. It could be a bad deal. It could be it's still being hammered out, even though a supposed deal has been reached. I will say that the timing is suspicious. The Iranians knew that President Trump wanted this during his 250th celebration / birthday weekend, and it ended up being done during that weekend, which kind of makes me think that Iran may have gotten a lot of what they wanted. But again, to your point, until we actually see what this is, we won't really know what's in it. We were told the strait is officially open, and then no, wait, it's not yet. Some people are even saying it could take another 60 days for it to be open to commercial traffic again. Either way, nothing seems to move until it's actually officially signed later this week. That's kind of what we're waiting for now, seeing where this goes from here.
It's difficult to talk about the actual deal right now, but I think what is useful, and I mean, which frankly I think has a longer shelf life, is just how, okay, let's say a deal does get done and that both sides stick to it. I think there's a bit of a hope in terms of how much the Dow Jones Index swings around, or how much WTI swings around on the back of announcements and so forth. I think there's a bit of a feel in the market that this is going to be a quick fix. And that is definitely not our view, right?
I think you're right. When you look at where we're sitting at today, even let's go back to last week, even before this was announced. You know, today, WTI is clean to $80 a barrel. Last week, we were, somewhere around 90, probably somewhere in there. That's, historically speaking, not terribly high. If you look at the kind of average WTI price for the last 20 years for this century, you're about at that $90 level, probably closer to 80, maybe a little bit lower, but not a whole lot. So to your point, you're right. The market seems to be fairly discounting this, especially considering IEA just came out and said, look, this oil disruption or crisis or whatever you want to call it, this is worse than 1973, 1979, and 2022. All combined. And we're still looking at oil at $80. We're looking at the SPR down at the lowest levels it's been, except for, you know, a few days after we massively drew down oil levels following the Russian invasion of Ukraine, or from when we started filling up the SPR. Commercial stocks are near record lows. Cushing stocks are near record lows. Internationally, if you look at, you know, Japanese stocks, they have the second biggest petroleum reserve outside of China. When it comes to IEA countries, they're the second biggest behind the U.S. Their reserves have absolutely plummeted too, and we're still sitting at oil at $80 a barrel. So has this crisis been solved? No, I don't think so. Instead, it's kind of been papered over by inventory draws, and inventory draws have given the illusion of abundance. They've resulted in we have not seen any kind of demand destruction. If anything, oil demand, gasoline demand has gone up, diesel demand has gone up. But at the same time, this is not, you know, supply and demand and the market balancing. This is very aggressive and coordinated draws of inventories. And to your point, it's going to cost a lot of money and a lot of time to even get those back up to some sort of semblance of normal again. And the market seems to be kind of discounting that that might be any kind of issue at all.
So, yeah, one of the interesting things here from the perspective of our mining industry clientele is diesel, which we've talked about in previous episodes, and we've done a few tariff talk editions on that topic. And I think the key thing here is that we're not going to get a quick fix. We may solve availability. If we do get crudes coming out of the Gulf, that will help crude availability for all of the refining sector in Asia, which has been the most impacted. But we will still have a bid in the crude space and in all of the refined product space as people refill inventories. And I think also for risk management reasons, you know, I think we will get more entities looking to store more of things like diesel, because having witnessed the risk once, you are much more inclined to, not always, but you're much more inclined to manage it going forward. So I think one of the key takeaways here is it's not going to be a quick fix, even if the strait reopens tomorrow.
I think you're right. Remember, the US SPR didn't exist until the 73 and 79 oil crises, which we just talked about a second ago. So clearly, yes, there is an increase, a draw on demand when you have some kind of a crisis and you need to be more hedged or prepared for it in the future. The other side of this, which I think the market may be a little bit ahead of itself on, is let me put you in the shoes right now, James, of an Asian refiner. You can go out and you can buy on the actual physical market, call it 80, call it 90, call it 100, call it whatever you want. You can go and buy that to refill as you draw down your inventory. Or every single futures contract and everything else is telling you that that physical is going to be dropping like a stone here in the next month or two. It's been saying that since we said that this war was going to be, you know, the equivalent of the three-hour tour from Gilligan's Island. This would just be a couple of days worth of fighting and we'd be done. Do you go and do you lock in prices now, or do you continue to draw down that inventory with the foresight that you think that prices are going to significantly correct here imminently? And the answer is you continue to draw down that inventory, right? Until you basically hit a wall where you are at tank bottoms and you need to restock. And at that point, everyone's restocking at the same time. We have not hit that yet. But I think it's fair to say that everyone continues to draw down their inventory on this expectation that we'll see an imminent end to this. And so when you have everyone crowded back in, buying nearer at the same time, you know, physical gets interesting. You could see some price movements there as well, because the way it's been described to me, I think it's a really good way of looking at it, is the entire oil market is like the human body and oil is blood. With the human body, you don't need it to wring every drop of blood out of your body before you die. You get below a certain level and it's a crisis and you pass on. It's the same thing with the oil markets, that once we hit a certain level, there are some serious issues that we need to deal with. And no one really knows where that level is, but it's not tank bottoms. It's not zero. So how far we are from that, I don't know. I do think we should all hope that this gets solved very, very soon and we start seeing actual flows into the market again. If we don't, it doesn't seem like we can sit in this kind of state of arrested development in the markets here for months and months and months on end. Again, no one really knows when that point is, but I think there is a point there, and I think we're closer to that point than markets might indicate just purely on pricing right now.
I think one of the interesting things you kind of touched on there too, Charles, is that risk management in the commodity space is not uniformly applied. One big example we see in a number of dry bulk commodities, for example, is that companies will buy and sell on index. They will accept whatever the market price is. They'll fix volume. And so they're hedged on volume, but they're not hedged on price. In the same way to your point about, okay, my reserves are falling, maybe I should buy, but when the forward curve is telling you wait, it really requires a CEO or a board or a chief risk officer or someone to step in and say, hey, yeah, we get it. We get what the forward curve is saying. We also know that forward curve could jump quickly and therefore we should do some buying now. I'm personally a little bit surprised that we haven't had a bit more aggressive risk management around this whole situation, and there seems to have been this sense of, well, this will go away. And I feel like I've been even saying that same phrase for a couple of months here. But it, yeah, that seems to be the way to go. Everyone seems comfortable letting inventories draw as long as they're not kind of sticking out from the crowd, it seems right now.
Yeah, you know, what is it? Revolutionaries get shot, right? That's the old saying. And, you know, you're not wrong. We started these podcasts a couple of months ago now, and we were, at the time, I was the only one, well, not the only one, but really the only one within our area that was saying, hey, look, this thing is not going to end anytime soon. We need to get on board with that. Everyone was convinced this was imminently going to be over. Everyone is absolutely convinced it is now over. I have some difficulties understanding that. But I, to your point, just from prudent risk management, your job as a risk analyst is to look at those what if kind of worst case scenarios and prepare for them, right? And it feels like that the scenario contemplated here is just so bad that you can't really hedge a tail risk like that and just assume it won't happen, which, again, very admittedly, it's a very, very likely we skate by and get out of this without using our inventories, which our reserves, which exist for that exact reason, and we're all okay. But that what if still exists, I think. And I think, to your point, that's being kind of discounted by the broader market.
It's interesting that it's being discounted by a market that has been through another very recent energy shock just 4 years ago and has been through COVID and lived all the various supply chain risks and stuff. So, yeah, it is certainly interesting to see. Before we were on air, we were kind of chatting about this latest deal and how it even though it's been called an MOU, it sort of seems to resemble earlier ones. And that, of course, makes you wonder, you know, just how reliable like or long-lasting any deal will be. And this is obviously going to be a fragile area for some time. And I guess, look, the takeaway here is, you know, our message to miners and so forth is figure out ways to hedge diesel. Store it or you know, hedge it financially or whatever. But I think there's going to be advantage to doing that. But it will require paying for that hedge up front. And the risk that the market settles and that hedge proves to be out of the money. But if that is the case, then that's the cost of hedging, right? And that's the cost of risk management. And it's just like insurance, right? No one says you were stupid for taking out insurance. And yet, I think a lot of commodity markets would benefit from more effectively insurance hedging, both in terms of pricing and also in kind of operational stuff.
Yeah, I mean, look, the memorandum of understanding, what it is or what it isn't, to your point, we don't know yet because we can't see it. We can only see kind of the Iranian side. But let's just step back here for a second. We were given three kind of ostensive reasons that we ended up joining Israel and attacking Iran, right? One was Iranian's nuclear program, or more specifically their nuclear stockpile, semi-enriched or unenriched uranium, and that needed to be dealt with. That's why we bombed those nuclear sites in June of 2025 as well, we were told. Number two was Iranian ballistic missiles were improving. And as they improved, they could range further with a larger payload, and they could start to threaten Europe and some other areas with some of their nuclear or other weapons, if that was allowed to continue. And we were told number three was proxies, that Hamas and Hezbollah and the Houthis and the Axis of Resistance, as Iran called them, needed to be dealt with. Iran needed to stop financing them. The MOU does not cover any of those three. So perhaps that will be worked in here in the next 60 days, but everything we've seen so far, none of it is included. So it seems like the memorandum of understanding / ceasefire / whatever you want to call it seems like a more formal ceasefire. And most of the important components are not being discussed yet. That doesn't mean they won't be discussed. And, you know, I stress that doesn't mean this won't work out. But when your biggest reasons to attack another country, a sovereign country, and your motivations for that are not covered yet, it seems like a pretty big leap to say, oh, those are some things we'll figure out later. That's the meat of what we're looking at here, right? So at the same time, when we haven't looked at those, Iran's only real leverage is the Strait. It's not hard to see where somebody doesn't see eye to eye, and we are right back in this mess again, where we've been for the last several months here.
Another big story in this that maybe isn't discussed enough is that it's not like you can just flick a switch and turn on LNG liquefaction or even gas production and crude production and refinery output. Those entities in the Gulf states are going to want some pretty strong level of assurance that the Strait is open before they start producing product that would not otherwise be able to even get to market. So I think there are enough kind of logistical things in here that mean a return to normal. I mean, I think our company base case is that after a ceasefire, it's at least 60 days before flows return to normal. And I think everyone would agree, probably risk to the longer side there. But you know, if you're one of the producers in the Gulf, you know, you need a lot of confidence before you bring that supply back. You got to be confident that new vessels are going to come into the Gulf. There are a lot of hurdles to jump, I think, before.
Yeah, you make a really good point on this. Everyone says, you know, past is not prologue. But let me give you an example here, a quick test for you, James. Okay. Back when the Houthis decided to shut down shipping in the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, and it shut out a lot of shipping because about 75% by tonnage can't even fit through the Suez Canal. So they have to go out that way when they're leaving through the Red Sea. Back when that happened, if you remember, we got a coalition of all these different countries, including New Zealand, Australia, UK, and I believe a couple others. Denmark may have been in there. And all of them went together and they bombed the Houthis. They wiped out 90% of the targets. Eventually, under Trump, the Houthis kind of agreed to a ceasefire. And Trump said, hey, you know, the strait is back open. Go ahead and send your ships through. From then until the war with Iran, what percent increase do you think there was in shipping through the strait from the day that they agreed to stop bombing to them?
I think I know the answer to this, and it's way less than you think, right? I forget. I've seen a chart.
It's about zero. It's pretty close.
It's about zero.
Exactly. Well, yeah. So again, there were other options back then. You could sail some through the Suez Canal if you have a small enough vessel. You could use the Hormuz. This time you don't have that ability. But again, past is any indication, everyone is really, really hesitant to start using these straits again after they've been shut down if there's a threat involved to them. With this memorandum of understanding where no one agrees to fight, remember that includes Lebanon. Israel already says that they are not privy to this. And in fact, as we were coming on to this podcast, I saw that Israel's hit a car and killed a couple of people in Lebanon. So with all of that, it's kind of hard to see where that fine line is for Iran to respond again with trying to throw a couple of drones at any kind of fleet trying to transit the strait. There's a lot of questions about how fast, just from an insurance and a risk point of view, if nothing else, people will respond. And on top of that, to your point, not only have most of the ships left the Middle East and the Gulf that could, and they're now, a lot of them are rerouting to the US and everywhere else, but the ships that are there are barnacle bound. Their hulls are barnacled. They need to get them cleaned off or their miles per gallon decreases drastically. Expand it further. You've got a lot of foreign crews in places like Iraq and Kuwait that are doing the oil drilling. Those crews have left or found different jobs because of this protracted problem. When you start to add all of these things up, it's just there are a whole lot of things that need to get solved to bring this all back online. And even then, you may have some of the aging fields in again. Places like Iraq may never get back up to full capacity because of the damage done from having to shut in wells so long.
I think one of the issues, and I think then we'll wrap up the discussion of the Gulf, is I think the rest of the world will move to de-risk their exposure. This is something I've heard crude analysts talking about. I think it makes a lot of sense in LNG, which we've talked about on previous podcasts here. And part of the reason there, I know you've done some work on the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, is Middle Eastern countries can react here, right? You know, UAE could build more pipe capacity to Fujairah, and, you know, Saudi could build more to the Red Sea. And maybe the Fujairah part's okay, but the rest is going to be exposed to Houthi activity. And even if it isn't, there's going to be a risk that it will be. So I think the rest of the world is looking at the Middle East and thinking, well, you know, obviously there's, you know, a lot of the world's crude and products and LNG and so forth coming from there, but there's going to be an embedded risk, right? We're going to need discounts, you know, crude discounts and product and LNG and whatever. But at the back of our minds, there's going to be this risk that, you know, perhaps Iranian activity, perhaps Houthi activity interrupts our supply chain. And in a world that's more and more focused on supply chains, I think, and that's a structural change that I think global energy markets will be dealing with for years. One topic that is not Iran-related, or not particularly Iran-related, is we have a new round of tariffs. Charles, you wrote a nice piece on the 301 tariffs that were announced. Is the tariff situation settling down now, do you think?
In some ways, I think it probably is. And in some ways, it might be a little more difficult than it was before. So we said way long ago when this all first started with tariffs, very early on, we said that using the IEEPA authority, the 1974 Trade Act, for Trump to execute tariffs was probably not constitutional, and it would not pass legal muster ultimately. And even at that time, we gave several different options of kind of how they could go ahead and do things that were under more solid legal footing. We said, for example, that we expected a stopgap measure to be Section 122 tariffs, which, due to international payment problems, you can do tariffs up to 15% for up to 150 days. And we said they'll do that as a stopgap until they can figure out kind of a more broad-based approach with these Section 301 tariffs. These are a case-by-case, country-by-country basis. You need a comment period. You need all these different requirements to set them up, so it took some time. But now they're set up. And now that they are set up, there is a lot of leeway and a lot of authority for President Trump to kind of use those tariffs as he sees fit. They're technically administered by the USTR, Jameson Greer, the United States Trade Representative, but he serves at the pleasure of the president, so we know kind of he'll do what the president wants. A couple of issues here, though. First, while you can kind of reduce a tariff for really any reason, if you want to increase them, you need to go through the USCIT, the Court of International Trade, to make sure that they say it's okay. By statute, this is a nonpartisan court that may disagree with some of the things Trump does as he changes them. So it's interesting and kind of worth watching to see if there's any pushback. I guarantee you it will be tested. We'll see what kind of pushback there is. And the other side of this is kind of why these tariffs are being done, right? These tariffs are said they're being done because of forced labor concerns within the supply chain. It's kind of hard to suss out where that forced labor exactly is coming from, who's involved in it, and figuring out a way to resolve that as well. That being said, you know, the tariff started out relatively low. This is not 122, though. There is really no limit to how high Trump can push tariffs if he wants to. Back during the 1997 or so, we used this Section 301 to tariff Japanese electronics, for example. And those were about 100% tariffs. So it just gives you an idea. There's really a whole lot of leeway here. So I think this could be interesting going forward, and a lot more can be done with it if they want to. If they go too far, you can see, you know, the USCIT stepping in and disagreeing with things. But it's a much more legally sound footing, I think, that this will continue here going forward. So it seems like we kind of backed off the relatively more capriciously tariffing different countries. That hasn't happened as much recently. That doesn't mean it couldn't. I think this bears watching. I don't think the era of tariff uncertainty is over. If anything, it's on a lot much sounder legal footing now.
Yeah, no, well put. Charles, just curious what you're looking at in the world. Obviously, we're all focused on the Iran situation, and you know, hopefully there is a genuine peace deal of some sort. But aside from that, what are you looking at for upcoming editions of the Tariff Talk newsletter?
So, of course, this week we will go out and write a lot more about the Memorandum of Understanding and kind of where that's headed. Next week, we will tackle the Bab-el-Mandeb Strait. It's quite interesting. I don't think it can be completely discounted. I think the market is really discounting the Red Sea and any issues we might have there. And I don't think that can be ignored. Beyond that, we've already looked a little bit at kind of our expectations that you would see an increase in producer prices, especially in the industrial and manufacturing. It's driven by tariffs, by, to your point, James, we're seeing record freight charges and costs right now because of higher diesel prices, fewer drivers because of ICE crackdowns in the U.S. and things like that, how that will affect input costs going forward and where we're headed there as well. With the whole cost thing, keep in mind we've got an increase to the federal defense budget of $500 billion next year if Trump gets his way, and I think he will, and how that's all going to flow through, you know, the markets and everything else. If you're buying something adjacent to military, like you want to buy a car instead of a tank, for example, you may see some sticker shock you kind of weren't expecting. So we're not terribly bearish the U.S. economy right now. We're more concerned about running things hot and another wave of inflation driven by producer prices. And the question will be, can consumers absorb that? Not just in the U.S., if you read some of the articles coming out of India, concerns about high oil prices when, as we said, we're back to roughly about where we've been the last 20 years and things like that. There's some real concerns in weakening currencies of some foreign countries as well. And the cherry on top of all of this is Bank of Japan's probably going to be raising their rates to 1% for the first time in over 30 years because they're trying to stem inflation too. What that'll mean for the carry trade and the ability to borrow cheap money and everything else as well. So yeah, stay tuned. We've got plenty to talk about. And I guess as we sign off every month, James, let's hope it's some more stuff than just Iran next month.
Yeah.
I'm keeping my fingers crossed.
I hope so. I think with that, that's a great way to wrap. If any of you have questions you'd like us to talk about, feel free to send them in, jstevenson@opusnet.com. Thank you very much, Charles.
Yeah, thanks, James. Appreciate it.
And thanks, everyone in the audience. We'll see you guys next month.
We hope you've enjoyed today's insider conversation on Opus Talks. Join us next time for a deep dive into another industry insider's world. You can find more Opus Talks episodes at opusnet.com/podcasts or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.